Sonia Falero is a journalist originally from Bombay, India, and currently based out of London. She's a seasoned reporter on issues concerning women's rights and global violence against women. She has published a new book called 13 Men for Decca, which investigates a case of gang rape in a tribal community in West Bengal, India. Sonia Falero is the only journalist to have access to all community members involved in this situation, the girl who was raped, whom she calls Baby, as well as the 13 men who are accused of the act. The twist is that in the end, we don't know if this really happened or if it was invented as a political move in West Bengal. Sonia Falero joined me from London via Skype. Thank you again for chatting with me and for joining us at KBOO. The last time we talked to you was about your book, Beautiful Thing, and this time you've published a new and again, really intense story called 13 Men, which is available on Kindle. So tell us in brief about this story.
13 Men is an investigation into a high-profile gang rape that allegedly took place in January last year in an isolated tribal village called Subalpur, about 100 kilometers or so outside of Calcutta in West Bengal. And in January last year, a young woman, she was 19 at the time, turned up at the police station relatively close to her village, I suppose, and told the police that she had been gang raped by 13 men. And that was startling enough for the police. But then she went on to say that the men who had assaulted her were actually members of the village council. And they had taken that official decision to gang rape her as a punishment because they found out that she was having an affair with an outsider, a Muslim man who also happened to be married and have children. So that was a no-no in every way. And she said that all of this had taken place in the early hours of the morning, and she'd managed to leave the village along with her mother. And this young woman wanted to pursue the case all the way to the court. And the police acted immediately, very promptly, in fact, by Indian standards. They immediately went to the village and they rounded up 13 men, all 13 men. And the police investigation started right away. There was a forensic team that was flown down. And the case went to court within months. And in fact, the judgment on these men was pronounced before the year's end. And it was a remarkable landmark case in many ways, you know, for the bravery of the girl, for the speed of the investigation, for the decision that was taken by the court. But there were questions that remained even after what seemed to be a very deft investigation. And these questions raised questions for me about the Indian justice system. And the sense that I get is that people within the justice system, from the cops all the way up to the judges, are trying to make amends for not having given women justice for many, many years now. And I think that's good. It's showing that they are committed to making a difference to how women who complain about sexual assault are treated. But there are still, in their efforts, I would say, to deliver justice, they're not doing a complete job. And it seems to me that these investigations and the decisions taken by the court are sometimes giving rise to even more questions about cases of sexual assault. And it was these questions that really led me to start digging into this case sometime last summer. And I worked in it for about 8 months. And it's the result of that work and the fact that I was the only journalist who got to meet the young woman who was at the center of the case, who met the families of the 13 men. And it's that story that I recovered, or rather uncovered, that is the basis of the piece that I eventually wrote for Decca.
It's incredible that this was kind of like trying to make amends for past wrongs and things like that. What's also incredible is that there's a second story within the story that everyone in the village is saying that the victim, this girl who's the centerpiece of your story, that she lied. So tell us about that component.
So, you know, it's understandable that many of the villagers would take would stand on the opposite side and accuse her of being a liar, because of course this is a very close-knit village, and many of them are related to the 13 men who were immediately arrested after this young woman, her name, I call her Baby, after Baby's complaint. It makes sense that they would take her the side of the men. But on the other hand, many of them were also related to Baby. You know, she was born in this village. She'd lived there for most of her life. Her brothers used to live there before they went away to get married. And so she had very strong links to the village as well. So it's surprising on one hand that it's unsurprising rather on one hand that they didn't take her side. But on the other hand, it makes sense. But the reason for the resentment, I realized, goes quite a way back. And it really goes to the fact that Baby was just not like the other villagers. You know, she had decided when she was quite young, about 15 or 16, that she didn't want to be just a tribal girl in some isolated village in West Bengal. She wanted to see the world. And so she decided that she would leave the village and travel elsewhere. And in doing that, she became the only person in the village, man or woman, to have ever left. Not only did she leave West Bengal, she traveled all the way to Delhi. She got a job there working in somebody's house as house help. She earned money. She bought herself a mobile phone. And when she came back a couple of years later to the village, I mean, keep in mind, this is a place where most people haven't even seen what a train looks like.
Exactly.
They're
exactly.
Pretty much all illiterate. They don't have running water, electricity. And this young woman comes back with a mobile phone. And she decides that, you know, it's okay for her to behave in the village the way that she behaved in the city. And yes, technically it is. It's technically, there's nothing wrong about her sitting around the village pond wearing shorts while the other women are draped very demurely in saris, or wearing sleeveless t-shirts while everyone else is covered. But this just really didn't go down in the village, because this is at a tribal area where people have always been, have always followed a very old set of rules. You know, they're afraid of outsiders. Outsiders don't like them. They feel that the only way for them to survive is if they live the way they've always done. And suddenly you had this force of nature barreling in after a two-year absence and turning everything upside down. And they really resented her for it. And from the very beginning, you know, they said, stop it. Don't behave like this. Adapt. Do like the rest of us do. And she refused. And she behaved... she behaved like a modern Indian woman. She said to them very clearly, in pretty much these words, you know, I'll do what I want. I'll behave the way I want. And if my family doesn't have a problem with that, I don't see why you do. And that resentment spiraled out of control when Baby fell in love with a young, with a Muslim laborer. He was 35 at the time, and started bringing him home. So this man, Khalik Sheikh, whom she met at a you know, at a construction site where she was working, started coming home pretty much every day. And he would bring presents for her of groceries and vegetables and rice and cycle into the village jauntily. And the villagers hated him. And they didn't say so to his face, but they just wished him away.
By the end of the book, I mean, I felt that even you didn't know what the truth was in this story, and that was what was really compelling. Tell us about how you felt during that process.
Yeah, you know, it was crazy. I flew into Calcutta, you know, at a time when the men had already been arrested, and the dominant narrative from the media, from the social activists that had already interacted with, was that they had, you know, that this story was set in stone. And because I do a lot of writing on sexual assault and gender violence in India, I have to say very unfortunately that there was nothing about the story that seemed to me to be just surprising. You know, when I read about it, I just thought, yeah, of course, this is who we are. This is what we do. And so when I actually started talking to people and people started opening up to me And I suddenly heard all these different versions, you know, and just to briefly get into it, what we know is that in cases such as this, where you have villagers leveling accusations against one another, there is often involvement of local politicians. They have a tremendous amount of leverage. And in this particular case, there is reason to believe that the villagers, as well as Baby, drew political support. But there is no factual basis to accusations that one or the other party was paid to lie. And the political angle comes in this way. The villagers, the tribals, are sitting on potentially, you know, land that is worth millions of dollars. Tribal land has been protected in India for a very long time, and under the law, nobody can go in there and buy that land, let alone, you know, take in bulldozers or mine this incredibly rich land without permission from the tribals. And the tribals don't give permission, naturally, because that's the one thing that they have. You know, without that land, they don't have anything. And so the accusation leveled was that politicians paid Baby. And Baby leveled this story of sexual assault. And the overarching plan of these people was that the image of the village councils, which have existed for centuries, would be so tarnished that the public would demand that village councils be disbanded. And that once village councils were disbanded, the tribals' control over their land would also be eventually liquidated, and that land would become land that, you know, politicians could use and do whatever they wanted with. So it's a very, if in fact the villagers are correct, I mean, this is an incredibly dense, very carefully thought out plot, but it's not implausible because, like I said, this is an enormously rich land. The problem is that while there are suggestions of all sorts of impropriety and there is possibilities, this or any anything else, any other, you know, sort of conspiracy theory could in fact be true, there aren't facts to back this. But the villagers believe it. A lot of the villagers, even those who haven't taken sides, believe that this is in fact the case. But the bottom line is that, you know, injustice in India is just never clear-cut. There's just so much pressure from so many people who want to influence what's happening. It's really very hard to discern truth from half-truths and outright lies.
You know, all of these stories that are coming to light in after the 2012, the infamous Delhi gang rape case, and most recently, while I was actually visiting India, there was a documentary that was released called India's Daughter. And in fact, it was banned in India, so I still haven't seen it. Even though I've returned home, I haven't seen the film yet. But you actually interviewed the documentarian, Leslie Udwin. Can you talk a little bit about that interview? I read it in Granta magazine. So I was reading a lot of perspectives. There were a lot of feminists who were speaking out against it. The Indian government had banned it being shown. Can you talk a little bit about your perspective as somebody who, you know, has expertise in the area?
So I watched it when it premiered in London, and I was so moved by it. You know, it just took me back to that afternoon. I was in San Francisco that afternoon when I heard that the young woman had died. And I just remember just crying. You know, it was really such a, I can't even describe that time, you know, to be an Indian woman at that time. And it was just very, very hard, because when we heard about the attack, and keep in mind that women are getting attacked all the time, you know, the number of reported cases are nowhere close to what is actually happening. But like we've discussed, all of us have discussed in different forums, there was something about that particular case that really came home, that really made us feel, that made a lot of women feel like, wow, this could have been me. And when I heard that she died, it was so, so hard. And watching the film brought it all back. And I think what I've said and what I believe is that, you know, the film is a Rorschach test. People see it through their own perspectives, unique perspectives, and they judge it through that. I saw it, when I did see it, though, I didn't see it as an Indian or an Indian woman. I have to say that I watched it as a reporter. And as a reporter, I thought it was a very well-reported piece. And I do understand people's objections to it. But, you know, reportage or a documentary is like a film, is like a book, rather. The author, the filmmaker, just like the author of a book, gets to decide what perspective they want to put in there. And I think she chose a very specific perspective, and that really is her prerogative. And that shouldn't stop other people from making their own films and writing their own books and discussing it in whatever way they see fit. I personally felt it was a very good tribute to the young woman. She captured a moment that needed to be captured. She told a story that we can never forget. She did it well.
Sonia Falero, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me from London on Skype. I really appreciate your time, and I really appreciate your contribution to these very difficult issues.
Yes, firstly, thank you so much for having me on your amazing show. Thank you.
That was journalist Sonia Falero, author of 13 Men, published by Decca. This was also an abbreviated interview, and you can listen to the extended version at intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. I'm Sari Gametta, and you're listening to Intersections Radio.